Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has written an account of the spectacular rise of the nonprofit he founded, as well as an interesting memoir on how to find your own personal purpose in life. In 2008, Adam Braun was a recent hard-charging Brown graduate who had a great Wall Street job at Bain & Company, but was haunted by a college trip to India where he had encountered a small child who, when asked what he wanted most in the world, answered, a pencil. Well, out of that exchange, Braun founded Pencils of Promise, as he calls it, a for-purpose organization that started with just $25. In its short five-year history, it's now built over 200 schools in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, delivering 15 million hours of instruction for children in poverty. It was recently named as a 2013 Educational Organization of the Year at the United Nations. Braun's account of his work and Pencils of Promise is a part of his book, The Promise of a Pencil: How an Ordinary Person Can Create Extraordinary Change. The book is as much about how to find significance in our own lives and how to act on it as it is about his own life. Adam Braun was recently named to the Forbes 30 Under 30 list and Wired Magazine's 50 People Who Will Change the World. And he joins us today by phone. Adam Braun, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
This book and your organization, Pencils of Promise, began while you were traveling the world and at a New York Philharmonic concert, two events that sort of crystallized your life's path. Can you describe those two events?
Sure. So almost the first thing to know is just my background. I was really interested in working on Wall Street as a kid. And so I'd open up an E-Trade account at 13, hedge funds was where I was working when I was 16, fund of funds when I was 19. And then the first event really struck as a junior in college, which was I was on semester at sea at the time, just trying to really get outside of my comfort zone. I just think true self-discovery exists. It really begins when you leave the frontiers of your comfort zone. And I had a habit of asking one child per country that I went through, what do you want most in the world? And I'd have him write it down on a piece of paper. And I found this boy who was begging on the streets of India. He was about probably 9 years old, and I said, if you could have anything, what would you want? And his answer was a pencil, and that was it. And so I gave him my pencil. He just lit up, and a couple things kind of happened in that moment. The first one was I just think that, you know, a lot of times, as much as we adults think that we have the answers, there's often just immense, almost disarming wisdom within children. You know, they just break it down to such levels of simplicity. And while I'm thinking, all right, this kid needs this or that, he actually taught me that the single most powerful thing to unlock a better future for him was access to education. The second thing was that a lot of times we feel like without, you know, immense wealth or power or influence, we can't actually impact the world or impact anyone's life in a meaningful way. And, you know, in this small act of giving one child one pencil, even as a young person, 21 at the time, I really felt like I was making a difference. And so that kind of set me off on this path of personal purpose.
You asked kids all through the journey what they wanted, and it was never money or fame. It was, I want to dance. I want a pencil. It was really interesting.
Mom said to me magic, which was my favorite answer, actually.
But it flies into the face of our expectations of children.
Oh, completely. But, you know, it's again, another one of those learning opportunities to say, you know, something with humility, we don't have all the answers. And sometimes they come from unexpected places.
Well, after graduation, after that experience, you joined Bain Capital, yes, the same Bain that produced Mitt Romney, and went to work as a consultant. But you were at a New York Philharmonic concert when something changed that would literally change your life.
Yeah, very much. So just to clarify one thing, I was at Bain & Company, which is kind of, which Mitt Romney also worked at, but then once they started advising a lot of private equity firms, they spun out Bain Capital. But 80% of Bain Capital is Bain & Company consultants. And so I really went to Bain to then, you know, kind of leapfrog over to the Bain Capital side. That was my original intention. Back then, I was actually offered two jobs before I entered the kind of full-time workforce. One of them was at the number two investment bank. The other one was at Bain. And against most people's advice, I took the Bain job, although it was significantly less money. It still paid well, but not as much as being an investment banker out the gate. It still, in a lot of ways, came back to almost teach me something really meaningful in that the company that I turned down the job at, that everyone said go there because it's so much money, was Lehman Brothers, which declared bankruptcy about a year later. And right as they declared bankruptcy, I was invited to go to the Philharmonic by one of my friends at Bain who had an extra ticket. And I was sitting there, my first time at a symphony, and I was just watching this one piano player. He'd, like, the whole, you know, kind of orchestra left the stage. One guy came out, and he played this piano piece. And he was just crushing the keys, playing with such fervor and intensity. I remember looking at him thinking, you know, this is what I want. I want to feel as passionate about something. I want to feel a sense of purpose in the same way that he must feel towards his piano. If I could have that in my life, I would be complete. And I had this kind of restless feeling at the time. And I think there's a lot of people, probably many of your listeners, who just feel like they're at a restless stage in life where they know they can do more, they can be more, they can kind of see more, and they don't know how to get there. And that's where I was. And I just, you know, I was watching it, was inspired, and had this name, Pencils of Promise, pop into my head, and it felt like a lightning bolt hit me. And I realized, you know, I can go on what Bain calls their externship, basically a 6 to 9 month leave to work for another company, and then they let you come back. I thought, why don't I do something entrepreneurial, and I'll try and build one school. And my grandmother was turning 80, and I wanted to honor her in a meaningful way. And so I thought, if I can build a school on, you know, the dedication plaque, which they lovingly dedicated to her, that would really give me that sense of purpose. And so that's what led me to starting the organization. That night, I actually went home and started writing out the charter. And about 10 days later, I went to the bank and I said, what does it take? And the lady said, you need at least $25 to open up a new account with Bank of America. And I was turning 25, and I thought, all right, this is a good sign. Maybe I'll ask for donations instead of birthday gifts this year, and ask for people to give $20, $25 towards my 25th birthday. And 400 people were kind enough to do so at a Halloween party when I'm born, and we were off and running from there.
Wow. And then you began, the book details how you began to research what exactly was needed. During some of your travels, you'd gone to Central America and actually were traveling by yourself when a Guatemalan, I assume farmer, came up to you and said, I need somebody to teach us English. I'll put you up if you will teach us English. And I think this is also part of this incubation of seeing the need for schools around the world.
Yeah, entirely. I mean, there's a man, his name is Joel Puak, and he approached me on a beach front. It was not even a beach. It was just kind of like a dirt area in front of this lake in Guatemala called Lake Atitlan. And, the friend that was traveling with me for that week or two had kind of stepped away, and so I was alone, and this man approached me and asked me to stay with him and read his Bible into a cassette recorder every day. And I kind of asked why, and he explained that he had taught himself to read English from his Bible, but he couldn't pronounce it very well, and that he needed somebody to read aloud into the cassette recorder, and then he had big headphones, and he would listen to it every night so that he could teach himself how to pronounce the words properly. Therefore, he could then teach the children of his community and watch them hopefully get access to a better life and through education. It was just such a profound shift in my thinking around development work and just how do we lift others out of poverty. And that, you know, usually you think of it as charity, but in the education space, charity doesn't work. If you think about any person that's gotten access to education, it's not because somebody injected them with it. They had to get it themselves. And so I realized the most important thing is to provide others with tools to self-educate, but not, you know, try and force-feed anyone some prescriptive mentality. And so I went and I lived with him in kind of the mountains for about 3 days, him and his wife and me in one room together in this shack up in the mountains of rural Guatemala. But he greatly changed my life. And although Pencils of Promise started in Laos, we quickly grew to Central America. And within Central America, we expanded into Guatemala eventually, and now we have more than 100 schools there.
Were you able to put a school near his community?
Yeah, so actually that's the region that we started in, was in the Lake Atitlan region. And so we have literally dozens of schools, and I've gone back and visited him, and he's ecstatic about it all.
Now, what is the need for schools around the world? I think it's about 250 million children don't have access to a school.
So the number is actually, there's two important numbers. The first is 57 million children who have absolutely no access to any form of education. The second one is what you're referencing, which is 250 million children get to fourth or fifth grade and cannot read or write their own name. So the 250 is actually more about quality. The 57 million is about access, but we have real issues on both.
Now, how much, I mean, as you're beginning to build schools, I guess that 57 million is the first target you're going after, basically getting more kids the opportunity to go to school, and then the secondary goal is to improve the quality of education.
Correct. Yeah, so we started more so on the access side, which is building schools and ensure that kids have safe, sustainable structures within which to learn. We actually don't do much of the building, so every community puts in about 20% of the funding for every school that we build, and they make that up not through cash, because they often make between $300 and $500 a year, as a family, so there's not excess money, but they make it up through materials and labor. So they'll collect the scrap wood and the gravel and the cement, they'll bring it to the build site, and then they'll actually do the majority of the building and the clearing of the land and the laying of the bricks, a lot of the unskilled labor. And so there's significant community investment there, but that really supports the first side. And then eventually we decided, you know, something at the end of the day, you can build a great school, you can have an invested community, but you need quality teaching in the classroom. So we developed a teacher training program. And then when we saw the kids were finishing our primary schools and unable to continue to secondary, oftentimes girls, we developed our third program, which is scholarships. So those are three of our core programs, school creation, which tackles the access issue, and then teacher training and student scholarships, which are more about quality.
Of course, education in the developing world and in severely poverty-stricken areas is so complex because you get into the poverty as one of the underlying issues that prevent kids from going to school. Basically, they're required to work on subsistence farms. They're required to actually contribute to the bottom line of the family, and that prevents them from going to school. Are you working with other anti-poverty agencies, or is this basically a standalone? Because it seems like this was so grassroots, it's been standalone from day one.
I mean, we work in partnership with some other organizations. The way that we usually enter a country is through partnership, and so we don't try and reinvent the wheel. We'll build a partnership with an organization that's been there for at least 10 years, build at least 20 structures, and not only can we learn from them, but they often facilitate the relationships to the high levels of the local education ministry. But usually within a year, we go fully independent. We build out our own staff. We have about 75 international staff, more than 90% of which comes from the countries in which they are working. So it's Lao people supporting Lao children. It's Ghanaians supporting Ghanaians, Guatemalans supporting Guatemalans. But, you know, for different programs, we'll identify partnerships that can support that community. So, you know, at one point in time, we realized, all right, this one community didn't have access to electricity. Kids weren't able to learn after certain hours. So we built a partnership with an organization called Luminade that provided solar lights so the kids can learn after hours so there wasn't dark in their homes. You know, sometimes we'll partner with nutrition-based organizations or water-based organizations to support the community, but we really focus on the education side.
Now, how did you get started with the first school? You mentioned you had a fundraiser at your Halloween party, birthday party. You raised a little bit of money. What were the first steps?
The very beginning was just starting with a birthday. So, you know, any other person can do it on our website now. They just go to pencilsofpromise.org, and there's a Take Action tab at the very top, and you just click on Get Started, and you can create. You don't even have to throw a party. You can just create a customized page that you can then share with friends and ask for contributions instead of birthday gifts. So that's really how I began. I wanted to build one school. I knew it couldn't have been much more than about $25,000, and that's now our key dollar point. So it's about $25,000 to build a school. Anyone that provides that funding, we take, and then we convert that into a school. We invite them on a trip onto the ground to see the community, spend a really meaningful 4 or 5 days in the field. It's often life-changing, and they get the opportunity to dedicate the school to, you know, they can do it for themselves, their families, loved ones, teachers, mentors, etc. But I really wanted to build the first school and dedicate it to my grandmother as she was turning 80. And so asked friends to give literally $20 to $25 for my 25th birthday, and 400 people did so, and that gave us $8,000. And then friends and I organized another event in New York and asked people to come out for the holidays and just give around $50 to $60. And we had a significant amount of people come to that, and that's how we raised the first $25,000. It was all through contributions of between $20 and probably $60 at a time. But we crowdsourced it kind of before the crowdsourcing trend had risen in the way that it has now. You know, we preempted Kickstarter. There was no Kickstarter when we got going.
Yeah.
You know, that was part of the growth. And then eventually people just started to realize, wow, I can create my own unique fundraiser through their website. So, you know, I was sharing with someone this morning, we just had a 7-year-old raise $7,000 for his birthday.
Wow.
Through one of the customized pages. But, you know, we've had someone ride a bicycle across the country. We have people running in marathons, half marathons all the time, creating custom pages on our site. And then we'll have a lot of companies that just say, you know, something I want to either do a percentage of proceeds from my sales, or they'll kind of say, we'll put up, let's say, $1,000 or $5,000 or $10,000 or, you know, $20,000 for whatever our employees will decide to contribute. And then whoever is able to contribute or raise the most will go on a trip into the field, maybe with the CEO. A lot of companies have done that as a creative way to hit the goal.
But literally it started with you throwing parties, basically, and
yeah,
raising the money to build that first school. And you decided on Laos. Now, you'd spent some time in Southeast Asia, especially in Cambodia. Why was Laos the first choice?
Sure. I mean, the most important criteria was I wanted to prove that this model could work within the most challenging rural impoverished areas. And I didn't want to work in a place that's really saturated with NGOs, with these nonprofit organizations, or as you've read, I like to call for-purpose organizations, because there becomes a dependency. It's unhealthy for the local communities to just have constant NGOs showing up, giving out things. And so I looked at economic indicators, and the two poorest countries in Southeast Asia, the region I wanted to start in, were and still are Myanmar and Laos. Now, when I got started in 2008 and the organization really kind of started moving by early 2009, Myanmar was politically cut off. You couldn't even get into the country. So Laos was the logical choice.
And you went to Laos. You looked over. You talked with the education ministry. Now, you were a young guy at this particular point. How did you get people to take you seriously? I mean, this is also a big story of the book, The Promise of a Pencil, is this sort of single-mindedness, this passion, and basically fearlessness that you've approached this project.
Right. Well, I mean, to tell you the truth, I actually think that it was pretty powerful and valuable that people didn't take me all that seriously. because the truth is, you know, I was young. I was 25 when I first met with the education ministry. They looked at me and they said, okay, you know, we don't have to think that this guy's going to give us tons and tons of money. So they actually didn't ask me for all that much. Whereas if I came in and, you know, a suit and a series of Land Rovers and said, I want to invest $10 million into your province, they probably would have, you know, tried to find a way to almost impact our model a little bit more than what's happened ultimately, in that we have a lot of freedom. And so I came in and said, look, you know, I'm young, but I'm passionate about this. I can guarantee you that over time we will build literally hundreds of schools in this area, but I need you to meet me on my terms, because I'm not here alone. I'm representing the interests of literally thousands of donors who have given small contributions. So we'll have zero corruption. We'll have zero paybacks to any type of government officials. And not that they asked, but I just wanted to preempt it, whether that was a concern or not. And also, we would operate based on hiring our own people. And so we wouldn't, you know, go through other outside contractors, which is where a lot of money gets used ineffectively in the developing world. It's through hiring of contractors who work slowly and inefficiently, and there's usually, you know, overcharging and kickbacks on a lot of different sides. I said, we're going to hire our own staff, we're going to use our own architects, our own build teams, and we're going to work directly with communities. And I hope that's okay, but I need you to meet me there. And I think that they thought, ah, this is this young guy, he's just trying to build one school, you know, sure, we'll let him go run with this. But now we're actually the largest education NGO in that entire province, in Luang Prabang province. We invest more money there than any other organization, but we built really great relationships and there's significant trust. And so I think in a lot of ways there's actually immense power in starting off small, because if you prove that something works and you build real relationships around it, it can scale without being hindered.
My guest today is Adam Braun. He's the founder of Pencils of Promise, a, as he calls it, for-purpose organization, a nonprofit that has built over 200 schools. I believe it's 206 currently around the world just in the past 5 years. They started in late 2008, began building schools in 2009. They've already built over 200. His book is titled The Promise of a Pencil, How an Ordinary Person Can Create Extraordinary Change. You mentioned that idea of a for-purpose organization, a for-purpose business, as opposed to nonprofit. Why is that important?
I think it's actually really, really important, not just for our organization, but for the space to start to reframe the language. There's, you know, 30 mantras in this book, The Promise of a Pencil, and they title each of the chapters, and the chapters are really meant as short stories, but ultimately to provide the guiding steps for any other individual to live a life of success and significance, which I just fundamentally believe you can have both. And the chapter that talks about this is called Change Your Words to Change Your Worth. And so, you know, I just found that I was chatting with a lot of different people, and I'm not a nonprofit person. You know, I've never woken up in the morning and said, today I can't wait to not profit. I've never met anyone who thinks that way. You work in the space for two reasons. You either want to lift others out of poverty by increasing profitability. That's literally one of your goals, is to make somebody else's life more profitable. Or you want to increase the sense of meaning and purpose in your own life. And so I just thought, why do we use this term non at the front of the introduction of our space? It's the only industry that says non. You know, you would never meet somebody who works at Delta and say, oh, do you work in the non-automobile industry? And so for some, ridiculous, but that's what we do day in and day out within this space that has over 2 million organizations in the United States. And so tens of millions of people introduce themselves by saying what they don't do. and it's actually a false description. So I just thought we need to reframe the language. Just shared it on stage at the Google Zeitgeist event in 2011, this different idea, and it's just gained a lot of traction since, that we should consider ourselves for purpose. We're driven by mission, not by lack of profitability.
And I think you write in the book, it says, you know, I've talked to so many people who seem to have an interest in what you do, but when you say you work at a nonprofit, for a person who works in a profit-making business, it's a turnoff, isn't it? I mean, they just quit listening.
Entirely. And it's unfortunate because a lot of times you can actually add value on both sides. I mean, you know, part of our goal when we build a partnership with a company is to make them more profitable. Because the reality is, if they become more profitable, and that's through partnership with us, that means that the only way that that's happening is if they're able to provide greater contributions to us in the meantime. And so I really believe, you know, as long as it's disclosed appropriately and handled with the right regulatory sensitivity, you can create a two-way value exchange. And that's the way that, you know, winning relationships are created, and an organization like ours is able to scale, is when we're able to prove to, you know, both startups and large-scale brands, and we build partnerships with everyone from, you know, Google and AOL to Delta and British Airways.
And to Justin Bieber.
Yeah. I mean, a whole bunch of different celebrity supporters as well. And we're able to prove, you know, something, there's real value in our work, and it's not just you guys helping the poor and being charitable. But, you know, you can find value in this, and we can help provide not only just, you know, meaning and significance in your life, but from a business standpoint, your consumers and your employees will be more committed to your company long term if you provide some type of partnership that creates social good. And as Pencil of Promise, we love to be that partner.
Well, take us back to Laos. Now, you've been operating there for about 5 years now. You talked about the number of schools you built in that province in Laos. What sort of difference have you made for the average family in Laos? Are you tracking that? Or are you beginning to track that? Is the province itself seeing a difference, say, in poverty figures, in, you know, achievement? I know it's only been 5 years, but are you starting to see some differences in Laos?
Yeah, so we track a ton of different metrics. You know, for us, the work really begins after the school opens. And that's when the sustainability work becomes most important. So we're in every single community where we build a school, anywhere from once a quarter to three times monthly. But that's, you know, quarterly is minimum, but the vast majority are monthly basis. And we're tracking everything from student retention to teacher performance to community engagement. And the truth is, you know, education doesn't happen overnight. It's not like a vaccine where you inject somebody and suddenly they're different. It actually happens through generations. That's the real profound impact. But it becomes immense when you look at it over, you know, a decade or several decades. But yeah, we've seen really significant differences. So first off, students in our schools progress from one grade to the next at two times the national average. When we have our teacher training program in place, students outperform peer communities by three times on test scores. And then the biggest difference we're actually starting to see is really in the progression from primary to secondary. And so in a place like rural Ghana, only about 30 to 40% of kids go on to secondary school, but when we have our scholarship programs in place, it's 96%.
Wow, that's quite impressive. And you start creating a new generation of educated people. It changes so much for the province. For one, you start seeing ways for families to get out of poverty. Families see the value of education and moving their family ahead as opposed to keeping their kids out of school and actually working in subsistence farming or working manual labor.
Yeah, completely.
The name of the book is The Promise of a Pencil, How an Ordinary Person Can Create Extraordinary Change. I would maybe argue a bit with the ordinary person, because what's really interesting is you have this idealism about this single idea of creating education around the world and creating schools around the world, yet you don't approach it from the traditional nonprofit. I mean, you have an Ivy League education. You wanted to work on Wall Street. You have that very sort of focused approach to dollars and cents and making a plan and making it come to fruition that a lot of nonprofits have trouble with. It's like they have the idea, but they don't have that sort of business acumen.
There's a lack of business acumen. I think that's one of the biggest differences between us and other organizations is, you know, the other reason I don't like the term nonprofit is it almost discredits your business capabilities. You know, it's immediately kind of written off as, those are the guys that are just driven by passion. But we're driven by results. As much as we have a beautiful website with, you know, moving photos and videos, what we care about at the end of the day is, you know, we have a responsibility to every donor. We ensure that 100% of the donations that are made online go directly to our programs, and we fund our overhead separately through private donors and events. But at the end of the day, if somebody gives a dollar to Pencils of Promise, we want them to feel confident that that dollar is the most effective spend of their philanthropic dollar, that they're giving to an organization that, you know, maximizes and stretches that dollar as far as it goes, and it has the biggest impact on the world. And, you know, I feel pretty confident about the fact that we're able to do that. And it's not because of purely passion. It's because of the business acumen that the organization is driven by.
You really lucked into, when you started this Pencils of Promise, that it occurred right at the time when lots of people were losing their job in Wall Street, 2008, 2009. And you had this great connection of talent that also sort of thought in those same terms, that helped you build your organization and get your organization off the ground. How important was that?
Oh, it was immense. I mean, you know, there's one of the chapters is it's called Find the Impossible Ones, which is about building an underdog mentality and then recruiting your early team. And then there's another one called Listen to Your Echoes. It's all about actually the role of leadership as something starts to grow. And it's actually not about you being the primary storyteller, but it's about others telling their own story through the organization and you essentially listening and helping craft that message, which is really your echo. So, you know, early on, you know, we were an entire volunteer force. We would meet after hours, and, you know, it's proof that you don't have to have money or power or influence to build something that really creates a difference in the world, or just that something that grows. I mean, it could be a for-profit business idea. In my opinion, as long as you're driven by mission first, and you incorporate some elements of, you know, broader purpose and service to others, then I think you can create something really meaningful. And I wrote this book, The Promise of a Pencil, to help people either get involved in an organization like ours at Pencils of Promise, or find the confidence and the ability to create something of their own.
Now, you've gone from one school in about 5 years ago to over 200 now. One of your mantras is, if your dreams don't scare you, they're not big enough. What are your current dreams for this organization?
Well, so that's the only one actually that is not an original. That comes from Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who was the first female president on the African continent. It's probably my favorite of the mantras, to be honest. But, you know, the dream continues to be, it's not even a dream. I mean, there's another mantra that kind of set me on this path. I saw it written on a chalkboard in a bar in New York, and it said, live not in dreams, but in contemplation of a reality that is perhaps the future. And so I live literally not in dreams, but in contemplation of the reality that's coming ahead. And that reality is the day in which every single child on earth has access to quality education. And so for us, the next step is starting to incorporate new technologies and teaching methods in the classroom. And that's what we call our innovation pilots. And so, you know, our goal is to get to 500 schools by the end of the next 2 years. That's going to take significant partnership. So I really encourage anyone that's listening and interested in getting involved to go to pencilsofpromise.org and click on the Take Action tab. And maybe you want to create a page for your upcoming birthday to share with friends, or, you know, get either your family involved or your company. But one, we got to scale to keep growing and building more schools around the world. And then second is to start to change actually what happens in the classroom and start to really figure out what the future of education is going to be.
All right. Well, it is a remarkable organization, and it's a remarkable story of how you embarked on this mission that's a part of your life. The name of the organization is Pencils of Promise. The name of the book is The Promise of a Pencil. Adam Braun, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Adam Braun is the founder of Pencils of Promise, an award-winning nonprofit organization that has built more than 200 schools around the world. He's also the author of The Promise of a Pencil, How an Ordinary Person Can Create Extraordinary Change. It's published by Scribner. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.